So like you all have figured out by now, partners is an acronym, and it represents each of the principles that we have been discussing over the last 3 weeks, and we will continue to today. So presence, aptness, respect, transparency, negotiation, empathy. And what we will do today is to talk about the two last principles of responsiveness and strategic support. And like we have been saying right from the outset, these principles are linked very closely to each other, but it is for the sake of simplicity that we talk about each principle separately. But as we get into situations and exchanging examples and case studies, we realize that each of these principles are really, really interconnected. So today, let's start by talking about responsiveness and what do we mean by responsiveness, essentially. I think responsiveness, as the word itself reveals, is our ability to be able to respond to a situation. And so that is, like we all know, an important facet to being able to engage with the community. Now, throughout our discussions that we've been having since we started 3 weeks ago, a common theme that has come up across is one of trust, and how important it is to be able to build trust with the community that we are working with. And responsiveness is a very important aspect of that. So most of us who have worked in any form of work, not just conservation, we know that how we make plans and invariably plans don't work out the way we might have thought of them to be. And inevitably what one needs to be able to do then is to be able to respond to that situation. So responsiveness is essentially about being able to adapt to the situations. And oftentimes these come up as challenges. So I can think of one situation or an example to sort of elaborate on that point. So when we started working in India in this region called Spiti, this was way back in say 1995, 96, when Charu went there as a student. He was essentially there to try and understand what was causing conflict between livestock and carnivores in that region. And through the studies and over the years of work that he did, we were able to identify certain reasons. And based on that, we were able to identify interventions which were relevant to that situation. So we've been mentioning the insurance program. We've been mentioning some other examples like coral reinforcement. Many of these were an outcome from that situation. But in around 2009, 2010, we had an opportunity. We had been working in that region for a fairly long time, close to 10 years, more than 10 years then. And the local forest department and the state government invited us to do a management plan. So essentially they wanted us to help them develop a plan, conservation plan, for that landscape of about 4,000 square kilometers. And that really gave us an opportunity to go and engage with more than the more communities than the ones that we had been engaging with. So it was the first time we went out and engaged with roughly 30 villages, which was something that we had not done before. We were still centered around 5 or 6 villages. And when we went into these areas, we were trying to understand what was the threat to wildlife, to livelihoods, and we were completely amazed by the response we got from the community. Any guesses what they thought was the biggest threat to livelihood? I'll just let you think, and you can unmute yourself and just mention it if you think you might know. 20 seconds. I can see some chats. Disease, disaster. Livelihood on livestock. Yes, Iftikhar, you're getting there, but what was the cause of predation? Yes, Raza, you are there almost, but who was causing the predation? Ranjini, I was hoping Ranjana would answer, but so it was quite surprising that when we went into these communities, everyone, literally everyone, mentioned just one thing: take care of the feral dogs. do something about the feral dogs. It came to us as a surprise, because that wasn't what we, firstly, we didn't associate dogs as being predators in that system, or, you know, while we were always thinking about wolves, we were thinking about snow leopards, we were looking at livestock, we were looking at blue sheep, we were looking at ibex. But here we were in a system where everyone, almost in every village, was talking about dogs and the amount of damage it was sort of causing. And so that led us in a year or so to start looking at whether this was, there was a pattern to it. And that was way back in 2012. Ranjana, who's part of this course, actually was then a young master student who had come and really done that work for us. She went back to all of those 28 villages, tried to understand how livestock were being. I don't think all 28 villages, but many of the villages that we had then looked at, and came back to let us know indeed that this was the case. And it has been a case where livestock are killed more by dogs in that system than by snow leopards and wolves combined. And that really got us thinking of the other challenges that this could pose. There was risk of disease transmission, Nilofer and Justine, like you said. There were reports of feral dogs mating with wolves. There were reports of feral dogs chasing snow leopards off their kill. There were records of dogs chasing blue sheep and ibex. There were all kinds of interesting behavior that started getting reported. But really, it was that point where we had to take a call whether we should be should we deal with this problem or not. And Justine, it was interesting that you asked that question, because we were posed by a similar question, but it was not wolves that we were thinking about. It was feral dogs that we were talking about. And in about 2013, we started some efforts to work on trying to control these negative impacts from feral dogs. Now, another important point in all of this is the importance of monitoring and evaluation. The importance is now, what do we mean by monitoring and evaluation? This can be done in two ways, I think. One is to have formal settings where you actually go out and do a systematic monitoring of the work that you have been doing to assess whether the threats have changed. Because remember, based on the example that I just shared, and if we think back about the principle of aptness, where we speak about how it is important to make sure that our intervention is addressing the major threat in the system. And so monitoring and evaluation can play a big part here. And so, like I said, monitoring and evaluation can be done in a very formal, systematic way. It can be done to understand whether the interventions that we have set up can work. Or it can also be done through on-ground presence. And so the picture that you see is a picture of our field manager in Spiti again, in the village, in one of the villages. And interestingly, we had set up this intervention in this village to have what we called reserves. So reserves are essentially areas which the community keeps free from livestock grazing. And in return for which they get some annual compensation. The idea there being that those pastures will allow wild prey populations to sort of bounce back. Now, after having run this intervention for many years, when we went to meet this community in this village, they had a new complaint. The complaint was that now there are blue sheep and ibex, and they enter their fields and they cause crop damage. And so that, again, led to discussion, negotiation, understanding the situations, and led to a simple solution of hiring a crop damage guard. So basically a guard who would go and physically keep blue sheep and ibex out of these fields. Now that worked in that situation, but it need not work in every situation. But yeah, that's the picture.
Interestingly, anything odd you find in that picture? Again, people can type in or. Anything odd in that picture? No women. Yes, Deepshikha got it first. Bang on. There are no women in that. Then there are no women actually, Justine. So it's interesting to point out that here we were talking about farming, which is an activity that is done completely by women in this landscape, but it was the men who are sitting and deciding. Now, I don't want to. I thought it would be useful to bring this point because it also shows that, you know, while we want to do things in a certain way, we may fall or we may not be able to at times. And so we realize that it's what we say in the partners principles are sometimes things which may be very hard to implement. But I think there is value to keep remembering those points from time to time. A last point I'd like to make about monitoring and evaluation, that yes, monitoring and evaluation can be a very formal way of, there could be very formal ways of doing it. And Nilofer, thanks for sending us your question about monitoring and evaluation and for us to be able to discuss this in greater detail. I think that's a very good point. We can try and speak about it towards the end. And I think Justine is the person, because Justine has been doing a lot of thinking on monitoring and evaluation, and she's been facilitating a lot of that for us. But yeah, there can be a very formal way of doing it, which is, there is value to that. But there are also situations like the one depicted in this picture where, you know, you are in a situation on ground and you realize that there is a problem or there's some new challenge that comes up. And so you try and respond to that. And therein is another opportunity. Is this a problem or is this a situation or an opportunity to start some new work? Because in the book, Charu also mentions about how we can often be faced with these challenges, but sometimes these challenges might be opportunities in disguise for us to be able to strengthen our relation with the community even further, to set up meaningful interventions. And the final point I'd like to make on the point of responsiveness is the topic of dealing with biodiversity unlinked interventions. Now, for those of us who were there in the second session, you might recollect that we did speak about this. We spoke about this very briefly because we did talk about it in the context of presence and what could be the possible drawbacks of presence. And one of those we mentioned was this expectation from the community to set up biodiversity unlinked interventions. Now, again, I'll just sort of remind ourselves what we had spoken then, because these situations can be extremely complicated and it's very hard to come up with a generalizable point on how these have to be dealt with. Each situation will require a sort of honest a reflection of what can be done or what cannot be done, based on which a decision can be taken. And what we had said last time or in that discussion was the fact that it would call for us to pause and see if the problem is a systemic one or it's a one-off situation. And possibly that could help us decide. In the book, Charu goes on to point about some more important points to look at. He says that if you were to start by looking at how serious the problem was, whether it was episodic or chronic, so whether it was a one-off or a systemic challenge, whether it requires expertise that you have to deal with, or is it something that is better dealt by someone who understands that system better. So for example, we spoke about public health, and there could be a public health related challenge in a system. Now, is it best for a conservation agency to start thinking about public health, or is it better for that conservation agency to bring someone with expertise in public health into that system, or whether is it best for the conservation agency to ignore that question altogether. I think that's a call that will have to be taken depending on the situation. There is no generalizable answer to that. And finally, I think one of the other points he makes is that how old a relationship is with the community may also be useful, because sometimes it's easier to have these more open and honest discussions with the community if the relationship is older than with one which is very new. And there he points to this aspect of how often we have entry point activities they are seen as ways to sort of make an entry into a community. Now, while those are extremely useful, one has to also be wary of the kind of expectation you're likely to set up with the community when you do those. So that is a bit on responsiveness. And the last point I would sort of like to mention is the principle of strategic support, because strategic support again is something very, very important. Again, this point had come up when, you know, Pravesh at one point, I think it was in the second session, we spoke about how we can be working on these small interventions with the community, but there can be these large sweeping changes that are brought in by a government and that can possibly undo a lot of the things that have been planned. So governments usually operate at scale. So they come in with these really big plans, whereas sometimes we might be curtailed by our ability or inability to be able to work or match those scales. But one point to remind ourselves, again, just like any community, the government is also likely to have those same concerns. So they may have concerns of trying to ensure livelihoods or providing opportunities of livelihood. They could have concerns of ensuring sustainability targets, which they may have made in these global conference of parties. There could be issues of equity and social justice that they also may be concerned about. And then, of course, they have concerns of biodiversity conservation. Now, in all of that, there can be times when they prioritize one over the other. And so keeping that in mind is useful. But it's only through slow and gradual relationship building that one can really start working with governments. And again, I can only mention an example, because often when we used to work on the ground, the local forest officers used to be a little unhappy with us. And when we really got talking, we realized that they were a little disappointed about the fact that we would never go and update them about what was happening or what we were trying to do. And I think that request was quite genuine, because what the officer told us was that you guys have been working in this system for so long, but it's literally of no use to us because you never come and tell us how we can make use of all that information. And actually what he was requesting for was not wrong at all. And that really became an entry point for us to start engaging with the government. But it's not the most easy thing to do. It is that fine art of trying to find middle ground between being able to convince them to take a certain course of action, which is in the interest of conservation and for that region. And so I think today's example or case study, we'll have Baira, who's joined us, and she'll be able to really tell us about this one example where in Mongolia we were able to work with the government to bring in a really, really important change in which was threatening to sort of undo a lot of the work that they had been doing for very long.